This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm interviewing Dr. Alan Duffy, who used to be here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics and now works at Swinburne University in Melbourne, Australia. So welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
How long has it been?
5 years, almost like to the day.
Yeah. Really? Wow.
Yeah, that's terrifying now that I think about it.
I thought we might start at the beginning. So you did your PhD here.
I thought you were going to go hard school and go right back to the Big Bang.
Oh, yeah. You were, the Big Bang happened, and then a few billion years intervened, and you were born, and then you found your calling in astronomy.
These are clearly the highlights for the cosmos, right? Big Bang. 36 million years later, Duffy's born. Yeah, okay.
But that does give an interesting insight into your mindset, though. So it's for you.
That was what you said. I was quoting you, man.
Okay. But it's cosmology was what you were, were studying. And how did you go about investigating cosmology?
So I had a supervisor, doctor or professor now, I think, Richard Batty here at Jodrell. Yeah, I guess I investigated the universe, which I guess is the job description of a cosmologist, two main ways. The first was to try to measure the big properties of the universe, essentially how much stuff is in it, you know, the properties of dark energy, this mysterious force seems to be accelerating the expansion of the universe, and various other cool parameters like that, using radio telescopes. Essentially, you map out the galaxies across the universe, and through something not too far from black magic, you can actually weigh the universe. Its big properties, like the amount of mass it contains, even the some of the properties of the dark matter particle, this mysterious new type of mass that outweighs the stuff that you and I, the stars, are made of, the baryons, by at least a factor of 5. So this is a very important part of the universe, which we don't know much about, but we can actually test the exact particle nature, or the candidate particles for dark matter, based on where the galaxies lie. This, to me, just still never gets, mundane. I just still can't get my head around that. So that was one part of my PhD, and the second was to take those numbers and feed that into a supercomputer simulation. This is essentially the way a lot of us do astronomy these days, which isn't to look at the stars necessarily, but it's actually to try to recreate a model universe on a supercomputer. And it's akin to baking a cake. The baking a cake analogy is you have your ingredients list, and that's, in this case, dark matter, dark energy, and gas, hydrogen, helium, the stuff that you and I are made of. Well, not much helium, but anyways. And then we have a recipe, which is our essentially our list, the list of physics that we think is important in forming a galaxy. So this can be anything from the way the material is distributed just after the Big Bang to how do stars form and die, and they have this spectacular supernova explosions. That turns out to be important for forming a galaxy. So you throw it, you have your ingredients, you follow your recipe. Your analogy is getting a bit stretched here, but your oven would be the supercomputer you run on, and you basically bake a universe, and you wait however many billions of years you want until you see a galaxy coming out, and you compare with real life, the actual images from, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope, say. If they don't look similar, why don't they look similar? And, of course, the first thought is, I've stuffed it up. And, of course, you check that a lot of different ways. And once you're sure of your simulations, that's really when the fun begins, because then you get to say, oh, well, what if I tweak the properties of dark matter? Or, you know, maybe stars explode in a different way than I think. And that ends up being a really fun way to just come up with new descriptions for the universe and really to learn about physics, because astronomy is different to other branches of science. We don't get to set up the experiment, change it in any way, repeat it. I mean, the galaxies do what they do, and we can watch. But these supercomputer simulations give us a numerical laboratory in which we can actually test our theories, our physics. So that was the second half of my PhD, and ultimately it's probably been the one part in the year since that I've really spent most of my time doing, basically ending up in Australia to help with the design, the construction of the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, trying to optimize its design for cosmological parameter estimation. So that's that weighing the amount of, or measuring the amount of mass and things. And at the same time, trying to do ever more detailed simulations to really just hone in on what it takes to build a galaxy. And that I can safely say has been my obsession for now quite a few years.
It's amazing, because dark matter is at the heart of these simulations, and it's something of which we know very little in reality, or we haven't been able to find what particles are involved, and yet we can see the effects out there in the universe, and you can build a simulation that follows certain rules and uses this dark stuff, and then it comes out kind of like the real thing.
Yeah, it's remarkable that the basic properties of the dark matter, that it's collisionless, and by that I mean it doesn't really interact with normal matter. It's streaming through us right now, through the Earth. It will just pass right through, and you know, the vast majority of these particles will never interact at all. That, together with the fact that it's cold, and by that we mean that the particles don't appear to be whizzing around too fast. In other words, there seems to be no sort of size limit on the size of a galaxy you can form. So, for example, if you have dark matter being hot, it means it's a sort of relativistic particle. It's moving very fast. Before the region, very early on in the universe, begins to collapse, it's slightly denser than other regions, begins to pull matter in. If the dark matter is too hot, those particles just whiz away from this collapsing region, and you just won't form a galaxy on that scale. You have to then wait until there's larger clumps of matter beginning to fall in, and that will then set your sort of minimum size of a galaxy. And it doesn't appear to be too hot. It's not clear how cold it is, but this is just one of the ways in which you can try to learn about the particle nature of the dark matter. But as far as a galaxy is concerned, it seems to be remarkably irrelevant what the exact particle type is, and which makes it very difficult, because you're really trying to... You're having to get to the real nitty-gritty details of building a galaxy. You have to get everything else perfectly right to then start to be confident that if I change my dark matter model, I'll get a legitimate prediction for what this galaxy will behave. And there are some very clever people out there working on this, and I'm fully confident that we'll hone in on the particle candidate over these next few years, but I don't think anyone will actually believe the detection until you have it in the lab. In other words, perhaps the Bowlby mine, local reference there, but you can actually try to see the interaction of the dark matter particles very occasionally with your detector deep underground. You're looking for a flash of light in the darkness, basically, and that will give you an idea of the exact particle type that this mysterious dark matter is. And yeah, at that point, I'm sure every simulator in the world will just have to rerun everything they've done, because it will be almost certainly be something we haven't considered before.
And are those experiments happening? I mean, are there also these light detectors sort of in the style of the neutrino detectors?
Yeah, it's very similar to a neutrino detector. And for good reason, the neutrinos are also very ghost-like particles. They just fly through normal matter, never interacting, or very rarely interacting. The dark matter detectors are... Yeah, they're built underground to shield them from cosmic rays. They're built of the finest sort of grade metals you can imagine. And one of my favorite facts is that the lead in a lot of these detectors, actually all lead is naturally radioactive. I mean, everything on Earth is slightly radioactive thanks to nuclear testing. We have fallout covering everything. And that's the glow of that radiation would actually ruin your detector. You would not be able to spot the occasional dark matter collision with a normal particle in your detector, because you'd just be overwhelmed by the radiation that's coming from the machine itself. What you need is metal that's come from a time before nuclear testing. And there just happens to be a lot of Roman galleys on the floor, littering the floor of the Mediterranean, you know, been sitting there for thousands of years. And researchers have actually gone and taken the lead ingots from these trading vessels and used that lead. It's been sitting in this low radioactive state for thousands of years, you know, has been cooling down, sort of thing, radioactively speaking. And that is actually what they're building some of these detectors from. There are extraordinary lengths being gone through just to get these detectors as pristine and pure as you can do to try to see the dark matter. But so far, we've not seen anything. And yeah, it's a real challenge. The Large Hadron Collider isn't going to see it. There's just no chance. But the way they may see it, if, you know, nature is kind to us, is that you know what comes in your detector, you know what's going in the collision. Your ATLAS experiment, the giant ring of detectors that surround this collision, will see everything that comes out of it, except the dark matter. So what you would actually see in terms of dark matter is the fact that there's a little tiny bit of mass that's gone missing. You know what's gone in, you've measured what's come out. The tiny difference will in fact be the dark matter. And as I say, we're probably just not going to get to the energy levels required to actually see a dark matter particle being created, and it's sort of the lack of the mass being noted. So unfortunately, that would be the best way to do it, the cleanest way to do it, unless nature is very kind to us. I don't think we'll get it that way.
Well, in the meantime, you're talking about the Square Kilometre Array that you're working on the Pathfinder for. It's a huge project to build a radio telescope. How will that constrain the properties of the universe and help to inform the sorts of simulations that you look at?
So there's a few ways, as befits such an enormous instrument. The classic way is that you get to map out the position of the galaxies. And, for example, as I said, the exact distribution of the galaxies lets you measure things like dark energy, stuff that seems to be pushing the galaxies apart. I should say that correctly. Appears to be accelerating the expansion of the universe. By measuring ever smaller mass objects, what you really want to see is essentially a dark galaxy, an object that is so small that the gas just lies in this dark matter blob and is unable to form stars. Now, that would probably be the smallest object you can imagine forming. So if you can see that, that will probably tell you what the smallest structure you can form, and that will let you measure the temperature of the dark matter. So there's a few different ways. You can also do lensing experiments, which is a little bit trickier, although Jodrell Banks is a bit of a leading expert on that. Measuring the bending of the light around concentrations of mass, and that can actually sort of directly image the dark matter. Again, you compare that with simulations, and you can actually start to constrain the nature of the particle. So there's this very nice circular experiment going on where the observations inform the simulations, and then the simulations in turn inform the observers, certainly what they may want to look for. At the end of the day, we have to be guided by the observations, but when it's invisible, you need something else, and that's where the simulations really help.
And will the SKA be looking mainly at the hydrogen gas in the galaxies?
Yep, so the SKA will track essentially neutral hydrogen, H1, all the way back to essentially the redshifts of what are the so-called dark ages, which are at about 100 million years after the Big Bang. I mean, it's an incredibly ancient time. It's called the dark ages because essentially there were no stars. There was just the neutral hydrogen gas. So you can actually get a full family album snapshot of the universe going back all this time. You get a complete picture of all of the local objects. As you go progressively back in time, it becomes harder to see these objects. They're more distant, fainter. And that's when different technologies within the Square Kilometre Array umbrella will kick in and allow you to see ever further. And that's the kind of exciting and yet terrifying part of the Square Kilometre Array. There are so many new technologies have to be invented. And then somehow we have to deal with the data rates that pour off. Some of the numbers, you know, essentially we recreate all of the information that exists on the internet today. And we do that every year without fail. It just keeps pouring off the instrument. And what you're looking for is, the proverbial needle in a haystack. But I mean, how you pick out the signal you're interested in from that amount of data, I have no idea. I mean, it's going to be a fantastic challenge. And it's one aware of some companies that are actually working with the astronomers to solve this data challenge, because they can see that the internet will keep growing. And eventually that will be useful for them, commercially speaking, to know how this works. You can search data volumes that size. So it's a real multi-generational challenge. There's a number of generations of astronomers will be designing, building, and operating this facility. But more so than that, it's a real society-wide effort where it's going to combine not just astronomers, but computer programmers, industrial technicians to just, I mean, how do you build 3,000 or 4,000 dishes and distribute them around? How do you power these things? Is it solar powered, or, you know, is it going to be geothermal cooling? And there's just this list of issues, and I'm not going to say problems, we'll say opportunities that the SKA presents. So at the end of it, it's all to help us understand our universe that little bit better. And I think it's wonderful that so many people are getting inspired to take part in this grand experiment.
It is fantastic. Well, you came to give a seminar today, which you haven't yet given, which is unfortunate for me because I usually like to listen to it so I know what to ask. But yep. I've seen the abstract of it. And it relates to what you were just saying now, the dark ages of the universe, and then this time, the epoch of reionization, where stars come along and light everything up and ionize all this hydrogen gas all over again. So naively, I was thinking, well, we understand that. Stars just happen and then everything switches on. It's great. Yep. But as you were explaining this abstract, we don't quite know all the details of the process. So what is it that you're going to be talking about today?
Yeah, so this is the real forefront of astronomy right now. We've now seen so far back in time, so distant in the universe, thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope and facilities like that, that we're actually running out of galaxies. And certainly the galaxies that we can see, these are the brightest objects. If they were any fainter, we couldn't see them. But these brighter objects, there's just not enough photons or light that's coming from their stars to actually ionize the universe. And we know it's ionized. We look around and all of the gas that lies between galaxies is ionized as plasma. And we know that since the cosmic microwave background, some 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe was neutral. This is why we see it. The universe finally got cold enough, protons and electrons to combine, giving you hydrogen atom. Ever since that time, the universe is neutral. But of course, when does it become ionized? And we don't even know that. There's this period of around a billion years after the Big Bang, which we loosely term the epoch of reionization. Reionized because the universe was ionized just after the Big Bang, but that's really all we know about it. All of these telescopes, all of these facilities, which are just coming online, they tell us that there is a very short window of time, some 100 or 200 million years, and by astronomy standards that's tiny, where the entire universe changes from neutral to ionized. We don't know what causes that. It could be stars from galaxies. It could be supermassive black holes that are very messily accreting all of the gas, pristine cold gas that's pouring into these galaxies, creating incredible quantities of radiation in the process, and that could be ionizing the universe. It could be dark matter itself that actually some candidate dark matter particles are their own antiparticles. When they meet, they annihilate in a burst of radiation, and that could also help. So there's all of these different theories. This day, the only way to sort of learn more is to actually do the kind of simulations that I mentioned earlier, where you have little model universe, you throw in all the physics you think matters, and you can ask these questions. Do you match the observations? You know, the biggest objects in your box, they look like what the, say, the Hubble Space Telescope sees. Unlike the observers, you're not limited in that sense. You know everything that's going on in the simulation, so you can then go, okay, well, maybe there exists a hidden population of galaxies, dwarf galaxies, and they could be doing this. They could be providing the necessary photons to ionize the universe. So my talk, without any spoilers, is basically going to show that it does appear that these dwarf galaxies can provide the necessary light, that we will be able to see this actually with the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb. So in just a couple more years, I'll be showing to be right or wrong about this prediction. Most excitingly is we don't seem to need any bizarre physics, like and bizarre in the sense of, you know, annihilating dark matter or even these quasars, these supermassive black holes. They're the brightest objects in the universe. And right now, I mean, it helps if there's extra photons from them. That's, you know, always going to do a difference. But right now, it seems that the galaxies, just very normal, small galaxies, can do the job. And personally, I was a little bit surprised by that. And yeah, we'll see in just a few more years if ultimately I'm correct. But certainly the simulations can then make predictions for other types of observations. And that's the exciting bit, because that's really when you put your money on the line and you go, okay, this is what you should be seeing with this telescope and blah, blah, blah. And coming to a radio center like Jodrell Bank is exciting because the simulation program I'm part of, which is led by University of Melbourne Professor Stuart Wythe, it's called DRAGONS. I have no idea what the acronym stands for. It's just Dark Ages Reionization something. Yeah, he made us pick dragon names, so I picked Smog, so hopefully I won't get sued by Peter Jackson. But the other components of this program are complementary types of simulations that one, you know, my hydro feeds into the next type of simulation, which feeds into the next. And ultimately, you make predictions for facilities like the Square Kilometer Array, which will see very large bubbles of ionized gas around galaxies. And these bubbles over time will grow as more stars switch on. And you end up getting a universe that looks like Swiss cheese. And that's the kind of observational prediction which you need the simulations to tell you exactly how that should appear. And then you need these vast telescopes to actually then check that. So again, that really cool feedback loop between observers and theorists makes it, yeah, a very exciting time to be in astronomy. You don't really want it to be any later, I think, because then you'll end up, most of these things may be answered. Although I fully expect there won't be.
Yeah, well, you
almost certainly won't be.
Just dig up more questions, I suppose. That's always part of it.
Oh, look, every great new facility, sure, answers some questions, but always asks more, always poses more questions than it answers. And indeed, the Hubble Space Telescope itself, I think it was, has only answered one question, or at least the top sort of 10 questions voted on by various astronomers. Only one of those questions was something that was posed when they made the case for the Hubble Space Telescope.
Right.
9/10 of all the cool science is done. It wasn't even thought of at the time. So this is why you build these big facilities and you make them flexible so that you can follow interesting new kind of questions. And I think radio has it best with things that go bang in the night, like fast radio bursts or pulsars which seem to switch on or off, or magnetars. Or, you know, the radio universe is a very dynamic, interesting place. When you up the scale of the telescope by 100 times, just imagine what more you're going to be able to see. So this is where, again, keeping that in mind, I would quite like to start to make predictions for these next generation radio telescopes to just, you know, get my 2 cents in there early on and see if I can sort of influence the design a little bit to maximize that potential scientific return.
And with the James Webb Space Telescope that you talked about, that's an infrared telescope. So these small galaxies, you're saying that it doesn't really matter how good your optical telescope is, that's not going to pick them up. You need to go to the infrared.
Yeah, so there's two things with it. You have that the light is redshifted in the sense that as the universe expands, the wavelength of the light increases. So what was blue ultraviolet light is stretched to the infrared. So when you look at these distant galaxies in the infrared, what you're actually seeing is what they would look like in ultraviolet were you to stand right beside them. So the James Webb is really giving you the perfect look at the color of the light that you want for reionization. It's also vast. Like, it is an absolutely spectacularly large telescope. It's so large that it actually launches folded up and is designed to unfurl like a flower in space, which hasn't been tested before, but anyways. And that means, again, the bigger is the more light that you capture and the fainter the objects you see. And it's really, it's the type of light, but it's also the sheer size of the instrument that means that it will essentially supersede what Hubble has been able to accomplish. But there's still a case to have both because they are sensitive to different wavelengths of light. So I hope that Hubble will continue to survive for many years yet.
That's fantastic. Well, let's finish off by talking about what you're doing now over on the other side of the world that we hear a little bit about, that you've been involved in quite a lot of outreach activities on a fairly big scale, things on national media and so on. So what's happened? How has that all taken off?
I've no idea, is the honest answer to how it's all taken off. But yes, I seem to find myself on TV now chatting about breaking news stories, trying to make these fantastic science sort of discoveries about space and astronomy understandable and more approachable. And also I do my best to try and sneak in some random cool facts that maybe aren't included in the press release or anything, you know. But yeah, it's fun. It's now 50% of my role at Swinburne is as a sort of an outreach person, which is just perfect. I get to do the science and then I get to talk about the science, and I think that's a dream. So it's becoming ever more, I guess, focused on the media. I still do a lot of school visits. I'll be going back out to the north part of WA, of Western Australia, to speak to a load of schools out there, which is fantastic. And so I get to still do my school visits. But yeah, ever more my time seems to be sitting on radio or TV, getting to talk about these things. And yeah, I have honestly no idea how that's happened, but you know, it does seem to be at least if something I'm not terrible at and certainly something that I enjoy. So yeah, that's going well. Somehow I ended up sitting on a panel show talking about Doctor Who as a national science of Doctor Who tour that went around Australia. That was insane. I have no idea how I ended up. It seemed to be, in my recollection, it was like getting this email going, "You like Doctor Who, right?" And I'm like, "Yes." And then the next sort of memory is I'm sitting in front of 500 people trying to explain how the Doctor's TARDIS works, or you know, or at least, you know, possible ways that might work. So yeah, it was pretty fun. And I think the most exciting bit of that entire show was that at the end of it, I was having all of these sort of younger people coming up, you know, 13, 14, whatever, guys and girls, and they were all dressed, usually they were wearing cool bow ties, Matt Smith style, Doctor Who. But yeah, they would come up and they wouldn't ask me about Doctor Who. They would actually ask me, oh, so tell me more about general relativity. You know, you used it to explain time travel. How does this work? Blah, blah, blah. And that was an eye-opener. And, I want to do a lot more trying to bridge the gap between cutting-edge science theories and the general public. And if you can do that in a way that's entertaining, that's got to be the perfect way.
Yeah. Well, maybe the timing is just right. I mean, Australia has been part of the forefront of certainly radio astronomy and other types of astronomy for quite a number of decades, but maybe there's just a point where it really catches the public imagination. And something like the Square Kilometre Array must be perfect because it's happening right there, and it's going to hopefully draw in a lot of those young people.
Yeah, I think that's right. The site decision was certainly widely publicised. I mean, yeah, most of my talks I go to and I ask, you know, who's heard of the Square Kilometre Array? And fully half the audience will be able to put their hand up at that point. And it is this idea of a global effort to build a world-class facility, and it's happening right in their backyard. And in fact, the cool thing about the Square Kilometre Array is that, unlike Visible Eye Optical Telescope, which is just usually one giant dish on a mountain miles from anyone, these radio telescopes are actually distributed across the country. So it's both Australia and South Africa. We'll have these dishes dotted around. They'll all be linked together to make this one world-sized telescope. But it means that you go to these remote communities who would be perhaps passed by, I guess, on a lot of, you know, groundbreaking science. They know that there's a local baseline is supposed to be situated just a few meters time, right by their homes, which I think is just makes it become that more tangible, that more real for people. So you're right. I think it could be just a case of great timing in that regard, that there's a resurgence of interest in science, and in particular led by this kind of a monster new facility. And like, who doesn't love big telescopes, right? That's also cool.
Well, it's great that you're well placed to just tie together the real research side and also the popular understanding of it, and just making it, like you said, a lot more tangible. Thank you very much for doing the interview, and hope the talk will go as well as this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And if you want to edit this afterwards, just make clear that it was a great success. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm just expecting some really, really fun, tough, nasty questions from my old colleagues. So fingers crossed.
Excellent. Thank you.